This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. What's the term sustainability mean to you? Protecting the environment? Creating economic systems that promote the greatest benefit for all? Changing classroom education so that future generations see themselves as integral, powerful, and responsible when it comes to protecting everything about our world? That third one may not be what comes to mind for most when the word sustainable is mentioned, but it is in fact the goal of this hour's guests. One is a former elementary school teacher who now teaches teachers how to teach. Another, a college professor who heads up a Virginia-based institute working to promote cross-cultural understanding around the globe. The third, a former public school superintendent who now travels the globe promoting new priorities in education. Got ideas of your own on how to change schooling, change the world, or both? The conversation begins right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. If you have any thoughts about what children should be taught about caring for the future of our world, you are invited to join in this hour. Our call-in number is 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page. Already on the phone line with us is a man who had been scheduled to be in Virginia this week in order to receive the 2011 Award for Sustainable Vision and Values from the Institute for Beliefs and Values. Well, actually, the International Beliefs and Values Institute is its entire name. It's based at Mary Baldwin College. Illness forced postponement of that ceremony, however. So instead, Charles Hopkins agreed to speak to us from his home in Toronto. Mr. Hopkins, by the way, helped write a key chapter of the United Nations Sustainability Protocol known as Agenda 21. And he serves as the UNESCO chair at York University in Toronto. Chuck Hopkins, thank you for making time for us.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
Here with us in the Insight Studio, the director of the International Beliefs and Values Institute, as well as a professor of psychology at James Madison University, Craig Sheely. Dr. Sheely, good to see you again.
Great to see you.
Also with us, a former Rockingham County elementary school teacher who is now a faculty member in the Graduate Education Department at Mary Baldwin College, Tamara Willis. Dr. Willis, welcome.
Thrilled to be here.
Chuck Hopkins, starting with you, if we could. You are a former public school superintendent who now travels the world encouraging changes in how young people are educated. So if you would tell us, sir, what it is that you're trying to accomplish and what does it have to do with sustainability and perhaps even what the term sustainable means to you?
Well, sort of three questions there. Let me start with the big one. What is sustainability or sustainable development? I think many people realize that it was the best that the world leaders could negotiate back in the early 1990s when we saw that focusing strictly on the environment was not really working. We had roughly 20% of the world's population that wanted environmental protection and roughly 80% of the world's population that needed development. They were facing abject poverty. And so the world leaders got together and over a five-year period negotiated the term sustainable development, that is development that will help in addressing poverty and so on, but it was trying to change from that sheer goal of outright development to one that would not impede future generations being able to meet their goals. And so it was sort of two terms, one of environmental protection sort of brought into sustainability, and the other term of development. So that's really where it came from. But then the big issue was, how do you do that? It's one thing to agree that development in the future should be sustainable, but how does one do it? And so at the Earth Summit in Rio in 1992, they came up with a work program of 40 different issues that needed to be addressed that all the world leaders, including the United States, agreed upon. And one of those issues was the engagement of the world's education systems, the world's public awareness systems, and the world's training systems. And so, hence, on the one hand, we have sustainable development that, I guess the definition is that Brundtland one, of development that meets the needs of the current generation without limiting future generations. But that's kind of an awkward one. I love the definition that came out of Africa at the 10th anniversary of Rio. It was from an African elder, and it was so simple. It was just enough for all forever. And the wonderful discussions that people have around what is enough, even take back Wall Street and so on. And then the term for all, does that mean my city, my religious group, my country? Is it limited to humans? And of course, coming from an indigenous person, it was not limited to humans and forever. The Scandinavians sort of built on this now, and they're changing enough, which has connotations of stuff, to well-being. And so the term of sustainability being well-being for all, forever, is there. So what we're trying to do very quickly is, what is the role that education, public awareness systems, and training programs, both in the public and private sector, how can we deliver on our chapter of Agenda 21?
Chuck Hopkins, I suspect that for many people, when they hear the word sustainability, they sort of assume that it has something to do with taking care of the environment, of protecting us against pollution, or even climate change. But it sounds like what you're describing is far, far broader than that, almost as if it is a welfare for all humankind or even all kind on the planet.
Yeah, that's more like it. Because when we try to implement an environmental issue, for instance, in Canada here, one of the great tragedies was the collapse of cod fishing off the east coast of Canada. Was that an environmental issue? Yes, it certainly was. But was it an economic issue? It certainly was for all of the thousands of people who relied on the fisheries. Was it a social issue? It certainly was. It was the collapse of communities, the end of many of the small villages, their way of life. Many of the people who were fishermen in the 70s and 80s are now working in the oil fields in Western Canada. So we tried in the 70s and 80s just to focus on environmental issues, or if you just try on dealing with economics outside of the environment, then you find you just can't really do it. So sustainable development emerged as a way of looking at social, environmental, and economic issues all in a sort of an interdisciplinary way.
So what is it that you are doing?
I'm looking at how to, my particular mandate is how to reorient the world's faculties of education. Because there are 60 million teachers in the world, and if we're going to engage world's education systems, then certainly teachers are a key part of it. Not the only part, but they're a key part. And so my chair was to engage faculties of education and through action research find out what made sense in a particular setting in a particular country. And so now we have.
So you've been traveling around the world, both researching and then using the research that you find to encourage different school systems, whether it's in a rural area in Africa or an urban area somewhere in the U.S. or anything in between, to change how they're teaching young people so that sustainability is a key part of what those children learn?
Yeah, and it's not just teaching about sustainability. What we're trying to do is to change the system itself. What is taught, even the buildings, What is evaluated, what is tested for, what is reported on, purchasing policies. It's absolutely amazing how school systems are changing, right down to the very purpose of education itself. For instance, in Manitoba, the purpose of education is to produce citizens who will live in a sustainable manner. Now, that's extremely radical.
Yeah, I guess I'd jump in on one piece
this
of this.
This is Greg Hewitt.
You mentioned a moment ago, Chuck, the kind of the interdisciplinary perspective here, where we're looking at multiple facets, you know, economic, environmental, political, cultural, mm-hmm. And so forth. From my vantage point, I would guess perhaps the vantage point of the International Police and Values Institute. One part of this that is fascinating to us is the whole perspective of systems thinking and how we encourage and integrate a more systems-level perspective into the curriculum. Because just early this morning on our wonderful NPR station, I heard a report about a situation down in Texas where apparently a report on issues of climate change as it related to a body of water was removed by the policy making body of the state, and the governor was involved and so forth. And what got me intrigued by that, as I always am when I hear these kinds of reports, is there's sort of a lack of recognition, if you will, about how systems interrelate, how factor X influences factor Y, which influences factor Z, and that you can't really talk about just one thing without looking at the whole interacting system together. And we need to teach that to people.
Psychologist Craig Sheely is director of the International Beliefs and Values Institute. Former elementary school teacher Tamara Willis is now director of the Environmental-Based Learning Program at Mary Baldwin College. And with us by phone, former Toronto School Superintendent Charles Hopkins, who now serves as the United Nations Education, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, chair at Toronto's York University. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you care to join the conversation, phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK. Ed in Broadway, thanks for using that number and calling in. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
The connection that I think I was trying to make in response, as in I've been listening to a small part of what's been going on, the dialogue, and it's how things are interrelated. Here at Broadway High School, I was able to take a class of Chem 2 students and raise the question about, are we connected to the Chesapeake Bay? And through a program at Mary Baldwin, we were able to sustain a grant and put a buoy on the North Fork of the Shenandoah River, which can measure certain things in the water in real time. And we are actually this afternoon, a little bit later, going out to collect some data from it. This was in response to the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, and then also the issue came up for us in a gas drilling company wanted to do hydrofracking in the Burgton area, which is just upstream from where the buoy is. So we wanted to have some data because in studying hydrofracking, we found out that they are not controlled by EPA regulations. There's a little phrase in the energy clause that says they don't have to follow EPA rules, and we wanted to make sure our water was staying safe.
Ed, it sounds very much like what you're doing at Broadway High School. It has some connection to what Tamara Willis is doing at Mary Baldwin College. So we're going to ask her to respond to what we just heard from you. Could you stay on the line for us? We have to pause for a break.
Yes, I can.
Good. We'll continue this conversation in just a bit more than 1 minute. I've got just enough time to let you who are listening know that we do have several phone lines open. If you have any comments, suggestions, questions about sustainability, you can reach us at 888-WMRA-TALK. Tamara Willis is Associate Professor of Graduate Teacher Education at Mary Baldwin College, as well as leader of that school's environmental-based learning program. Chuck Hopkins is co-author of one of the key chapters in the United Nations Sustainability Protocol known as Agenda 21. Craig Sheely is a professor of psychology at James Madison University, as well as executive director of the International Beliefs and Values Institute based at Mary Baldwin. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Tamara, you want to respond to what we were just hearing from Ed at Broadway High School?
Yes, I love what Ed's doing with his students at Broadway High School. He took a class at Mary Baldwin maybe about a year ago, Ed. Then we were able to give him some support through a NOAA grant to implement this buoy project with his students. And it fits really nicely with the sort of philosophy we have in our environment-based learning degree program. We have a Master of Education in Environment-Based Learning at Mary Baldwin. And we follow this same holistic and interdisciplinary approach that Charles was talking about earlier. What we want to do with teachers is get them to use real-world issues related to the local environment as a catalyst for teaching the content in all subjects. And so we encourage them to take a look at their local community, think about issues that are going on in the community at the time, make that part of their program, and in doing that, cover math, science, social studies, language arts with the students. And what this does is it brings in, you know, real-world issues. It makes learning real and relevant to the students. They care about it, so they actually learn better because of this approach.
And Tamara, I understand that you grew up, you spent much of your childhood on the East Coast of North Carolina.
That's correct.
And I don't know if you thought of yourself as a tomboy, but the story that I've heard is you loved spending lots of time outdoors. But it wasn't until some science class that you were taking in college that you realized what you were learning, spending all that time outdoors, was science?
That's correct. I never connected what I was learning in elementary and high school and even early years of college with a love of science. In fact, I was kind of afraid of science.
So what you were trying to do now is to encourage children in elementary, middle, and high school to have a completely different experience than what you had, to make that connection between all kinds of things that are going on in the world around them, to get outdoors, and whether it's connections with science, connections with math, connections with literature.
Yes, that's correct. We've had some language arts teachers who have taken this approach, take their kids outside, and use it for reading and writing activities with their students through nature journaling or other kinds of journaling.
Ed at Broadway High School, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. Going next to McGackiesville, Eric, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Tamara Willis, Chuck Hopkins, and or Craig Sheely, please.
Yes, I would just like to add to the discussion a talk I got to give to the directors of the EPAs of North America in June. The talk was the establishment of soil carbon as the universal measure of sustainability. Since all these things have to do with renewable energy, and much renewable energy talk is going toward biomass, this talk was about biomass systems of thermal conversion that actually build soil carbon as they deliver nutrient-dense foods and energy and sustainability.
And you say you were talking to the EPAs of North America. Does that mean state government environmental agencies or national government? And from...
Yeah, it was Lisa Jackson, Juan Quesada, the environmental minister of Mexico, and Peter Kent of Canada. It was June 22nd. You can see a video of it if you go to the Commission of Environmental Cooperation. And it was testimony given by the three North American signatories of the NAFTA agreement.
And so what kind of response did you get to your presentation, Eric?
It was pretty exciting. I've been doing this work for the last 5 years, and I was thrown into the arms of Juan Quesada's right-hand men, and so far, so good. This whole area of research on biofuels to build soil carbon is only a decade old, if not that. but it was very well received. And other work in the same area I've gotten going on in the valley. DuPont is actually boots on the ground doing biochar remediation of the mercury that's in the Shenandoah River. And their initial results are very, very exciting.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for taking the time to share some of your experience with us. Before I ask our guests to respond, I'm going to move on to one more call and get another perspective and then ask the three of you to respond to what both of these callers have to say. Now, this is Georgia from New Hope on the line with us. Georgia, your question or comment, please.
Yes, I had a question about the abolishment of property rights or private property. It said that I was understanding the United Nations wants to abolish private property worldwide, and the UN Agenda 21 is their tool, and locally governments are already cooperating. What do you have to say about that? Because private property is just that. It's private property.
Chuck Hopkins, I don't know if this is your area or not, but you have some affiliation with Agenda 21.
I can comment on that. As one of the authors, I've never seen that discussed or written, but I keep hearing it as I travel around, that is the intent of the United Nations. You have to understand the United Nations is simply a meeting place for countries. You know, it really is almost like a I wouldn't want to say a club that, but in essence, that's what it is. But that idea that the United Nations wants to abolish all private property is just nonsense.
Does that respond to your question, Georgia?
I'm sorry?
Does that respond to your question?
It responds it, but I mean, I have a website right here telling me that's exactly what the United Nations is.
Is it a United Nations website? Or is it someone's comment? What you wanted, you can go into and Google United Nations and then add to it Rio Agenda 21. And hopefully you'll be able to get a website that has the original documents on it and read through them. They're not all that long. There are 40 chapters. Each chapter is about 5 or 6 pages.
That's what I Googled, was Agenda 21, Rio, and property.
Did you end up with a United Nations website or somebody commenting about the United Nations?
It is in their conference. It's in the Rio Declaration at that conference. It says.
Georgia, did you hear my question? Are you on a United Nations website or are you on a site that is commenting about the United Nations?
UN Department of Economic and Social Affairs.
That's what the website is that you are on?
Yes.
Okay. Would you do me a favor? Mm-hmm. Would you send us a copy of the website address at insight@jmu.edu? Because we'd love to check that and compare it to what Chuck Hopkins is telling us. In essence, Chuck, what you're saying is that's not what's in the United Nations Agenda 21,
yeah,
and that would not be what the United Nations websites are showing.
I can't imagine that ever being approved by the countries of the world. I can never imagine the United States agreeing to that.
So, Georgia, if you would send us that website, obviously we can't prove visually over the air what the website looks like, but then once you send us that address, we can post it on our Facebook page.
Okay.
Thank you so much for taking the time. Our address again is insight@jmu.edu. And does anybody want to respond to what Eric was saying before about the progress that he thinks is being made on biocarbon?
Well, I could comment on that one as well. That's a great sort of comment on the training and the public awareness aspects of what we're trying to do under education, public awareness, and training about sustainability, how we're making progress. Really what he's talking about is environmental sustainability. And no one group can do everything. No one group can do all the environmental, all the social, all the economic, etc. But for instance, we shouldn't lose track that there are these other aspects. For instance, the whole Arab Spring, is that's social sustainability, and we have many different ones. So using his soil carbon as the indicator, as he kind of mentioned, I don't think that would really fly, but as an indicator, I think it is an excellent one. Most people have no idea of the carbon cycle. If you ask how does a tree grow, not that many people would explain that it's really carbon sequestering.
International sustainability activist Chuck Hopkins is with us by phone. Here in the Insight Studio, psychologist Craig Sheely, as well as professor of education, Tamara Willis. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We're getting several comments in now by Facebook, and I will read some of them. But once again, let me say that since we have several phone lines open, it's generally more interesting to hear your voice than to hear me read your comments. So if you're not too shy and you're willing to express yourself by phone, the number to use is 888-967-2825. Easy to remember as 888-WMRA Talk. This is from Tim, who posted on Facebook, quote, "The challenge I find in working with teachers around topics of sustainability is that I have to invest a great deal of startup conversation to explain the topic of sustainability before discussing with teachers the actions they might take to address this with students. Unfortunately, sustainability is not an issue on teachers' radar. It's buried too deeply behind other schooling requirements to even get around to thinking about." You're nodding your head, Tamara.
Well, sustainability should be maybe not the main thing that you're trying to get through to teachers. What you want to do is have teachers experience things in the outdoors, take them out, bring in issues of the local environment, and show them how they can use those as a way to make to motivate their students to learn in all subjects. And in doing that, they are going to connect with the environment. It happens so often. And from there, the teachers will share with their students issues facing the environment. And it just... It's the natural flow of things. Getting that experience for the teachers is the most important part.
So this idea of understanding what is meant by the term sustainability, it sounds like you think maybe Tim has a point. But once you get past that, there are all kinds of ways that you can include sustainability in different types of lessons and still stay on target with all of the standardized testing that teachers have to do?
Well, I think in researching the issues of a local community, the students themselves will raise these questions. And the teachers just sort of can facilitate the student learning in that direction.
Sandy in Fishersville, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
Hi, yes. Specifically talking about sustainability in education, I can tell you that it's already taking place within the schools. I have quite a few kids in the school system. And
as a parent or as a teacher?
I'm a parent.
Okay.
And specifically, I'm one of the people mentioned the changing the purpose of education. The purpose of education should never change. The purpose of education is to teach our kids to read, write, and do math. And currently, our scores in reading are down 14th, we're 17th in science, and 25th in math. And I'm sorry, but I can't help but think this is somewhat the result of the sustainable teaching going on in the classroom. And having reviewed the SOLs, I can assure you it's there. And, for instance, they talk about land uses compatible with open space and residential. They talk about the mitigation of land use. They talk about cooperation may eliminate the need for the division and control of the Earth's surface. This is a global agenda. It is in opposition to my constitutional, to my God-given individual property rights. I have a problem with this sustainable agenda being taught. It's a propaganda being taught to my children, brought into the school system. We don't need an agenda to teach science and math. It's fine to go outdoors. That's great. But teach them science and math and reading, not an agenda.
But you know, what if you don't want to teach students what to think. What we want to do is teach them how to think. And so in not pushing an agenda, but pushing a methodology that will motivate students to learn is what we're all about. It's not to teach an agenda. What you want is to have your students become critical thinkers and problem solvers and learn the content of math and science and social studies and language arts in a way that helps them become better citizens so that they are knowledgeable about the earth, they understand how things work, and they know how to take steps to improve things. That's what you want. So you want your students to become better citizens. And that's, to me, what a sustainable education is all about.
Well, that's not currently what's being taught. What's currently being taught, and perhaps you have a grand new plan, but it's currently being taught, urban development is being taught. These are very specific things. They're not teaching these kids how to think. They're teaching them what to think. They're teaching them where to live. They're teaching them that cattle can't be near streams. They're teaching them. That's not critical thinking. That's teaching them an agenda. The SOLs, it's in the SOLs. So I hope that you succeed in teaching our kids to be critical thinkers, because that is the purpose of education.
You know, Craig here, just to jump in on this, both the call here and the call about the UN raises, for me at least, what's the most important, quite frankly, issue with all of this. We can, and Chuck and Tamara, doing really crucial work to try to organize content and get it out there through delivery systems, through networking and curricular development and so forth. It's essential. But the other piece of the puzzle is trying to understand how do we create spaces for dialogue between people who have fundamentally different value sets regarding what really matters, what's real. The two callers, the UN person and the most recent person, you can hear both from what they say and from how they say it that they're really upset about the whole agenda of education for sustainable development for different but complementary reasons. Mm-hmm. And from my perspective, at least, until we sort of the educators, the academics who attempt to move this stuff forward, until we really appreciate where these folks are coming from and why, what's driving the anxiety, and do it in a respectful way where we really listen, until we have those kinds of dialogues and we, quite frankly, build it into our curricula. So there are processes for really having an encounter at that level. I think we're going to continue banging our head into the wall here in terms of trying to move this whole perspective forward and into more mainstream curricular approaches.
Sandy, thank you so much for giving us a chance to hear your perspective and to listen. Nancy in Harrisonburg, you're on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Craig Sheely, Tamara Willis, and or Chuck Hopkins, please.
Well, actually, I have two comments. One, I recently, last night, picked up the November issue of Scientific American, and there's an article in here about fracking. I haven't read it yet, but I think it should be of interest. And the other comment, when we talk about sustainability, I think we also have to address the population issue.
Those are both great issues. You may be able to hear the music, Nancy, which means we're going to hit the break any second now and the computer is going to cut us off. So what I'm going to do is ask our guests to respond to those issues, fracking and population growth, when we get back from the break. Thank you so much for calling in. You have Virginia Insight on your radio or streaming online at WMRA.org. I'm Tom Graham. The Republican strategist and Fox News commentator Noel Nickpour appeared on television recently to once again charge that, quote, scientists are scamming the American people right and left for their own financial gain, end quote. Now, granted, this most recent appearance was on The Daily Show, and her comments were edited that time for comic effect, but her sentiments have been reflected in many other quarters, including among some Republican members of Congress. So my question for you listening in, how much esteem do you hold science in today in our society? Is there something you think needs to be done in schools or elsewhere to improve the image and believability of mainstream science? Our call-in number is 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967. 2825. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Just before we pause for the break, Nancy expressed a concern about making sure students are taught appropriate things about fracking and population growth. Chuck, you have a response to either of those?
Well, I think at the heart of the population one, 20 years ago, we thought that was going to really be the big issue. The population growth is enormous. In fact, we think this Monday, statistically, the world should cross over to 7 billion people. Now, we had hoped that, because we can see an end in it, wherever the population, the average level of education in a country, rather, is above grade 4, reproduction rate starts to drop and drops dramatically. There are only about 10 or 12 countries left in the world with really runaway populations, and those are war-torn countries. So the answer to population is education, and education of women. Now, one of the drawbacks to the recession is for the last 4 or 5 years, the countries in their foreign aid have cut back on population education. And we're probably not going to meet the targets. We're probably now going to not peak at 9. It'll probably be closer to 10 billion people. Now, this means that our young people are going to have to look after almost 50%, 40% more people on the planet using less water. We're already drilling down and using prehistoric water. We're not living on natural rainfall. We're destroying a fair bit of water through pollution. And again, the fracking and other things that we're doing to underground water, etc. So, and our children are going to have to look after this 40% using less land. We're not only destroying topsoil, but deserts are growing. Desertification is a huge issue. And you know, we can go on with these kinds of issues. So what kind of an education is the most appropriate? And on the one hand, we have it's math, language, and science, or math, language, religion, and science in some countries. And in other countries, it's focusing more on the idea of creative thinking, critical thinking, data management, etc. And it doesn't have to be either or, because the good news is that the countries that are up at the top of the PISA scores that was just mentioned by, I think, the caller from Georgia.
I'm sorry, you said PISA scores?
Yeah, PISA, Performance Indicators Student Achievement. It is an international ranking of math and language according to country, and she was indicating how low the United States ranks on these. Now, the countries up at the very top use the kind of techniques that Tamara is talking about, that where it is, there are three levels of curriculum. There is a very small national curriculum. There is a state or regional curriculum. And then the teachers themselves have a great deal of latitude in developing their own school curriculum. And in that case, they can then delve into local reality issues. The students can study things that are meaningful to them and what they're passionate about. And the math and the science scores come along with it. They don't ignore it, but their language arts and math and all the other subjects are taught through something that is really meaningful to the students. So countries such as Finland, they're right up the top along with Shanghai, Singapore, Hong Kong. Canada does very well up at the top. So you're not trading off anything by dealing with a curriculum that is actually preparing students for the world they're going to inherit from us. But simply focusing on drill and kill, it just proves over and over again with all of the testing that goes on in the United States, it really does not help.
We have this on Facebook from Laura, who says, quote, at a recent conference of the Association for the Advancement of Sustainability in Higher Education, I heard an excellent suggestion from Dr. Tom Kelly from the University of New Hampshire about how to define sustainability. He suggests that instead of getting lost in definitions that no one will ever agree upon, we instead simply ask, what sustains us? And then follow with, how do we sustain the things that sustain us? This struck me as an excellent way for teachers to introduce the concept to students. I've tried it with my environmental studies undergrads, and they seem to get it. I'm guessing Laura teaches college somewhere. I'm wondering, Tamara Willis, if you think something similar is going to work with elementary and middle school students.
Yes, I think that would work great with elementary students if you put it to their on their level. And, you know, we have one way to do that is with something that's more focused on a local or a curriculum that is, relates to them. And one that I can talk about is something called Trout in the Classroom. And in this program, it's developed by Trout Unlimited. The kids raise the trout from eggs, and they hatch in the aquarium in the classroom. And the kids really connect to that, and they have to understand the sustainability of that one environment where these trout are raised. And so what Charles was talking about, these students really learn, even if they're young children, they really learn chemistry. They understand life cycles because of this program. And then they release the trout, so they have to understand the stream, what's going on in the stream where they're going to release the trout. So that's a program where you can even work with young children to cover sustainability. You might not call it that, but it makes the case of what he was discussing.
Tamara Willis is Associate Professor of Graduate Teacher Education at the Mary Baldwin College campus, as well as leader of that school's environmental-based learning program. Chuck Hopkins is co-author of one of the key chapters in the United Nations Sustainability Protocol, known as Agenda 21. Craig Sheely is a professor of psychology at James Madison University, as well as executive director of the International Beliefs and Values Institute, based at Mary Baldwin College. We've got just a couple more minutes to take phone calls, and we do have a couple of lines open at the moment. So if you've been thinking about joining the conversation, please don't put it off. Phone line open at 888-WMRA-TALK. 888-967-2825. Glenn in Woodstock, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd just like to say that unless you start to incorporate an actual history of the environment, because the current study of American history does not take into account what we've done to get to the point where we are, so we know how to go forward. And I'm particularly talking about, I feel that a required reading should be Pristine Myth by Danovan for every high school student.
Anybody want to respond to that?
Yeah, the whole sustainability movement, I feel, is rooted in our indigenous peoples. You know, it is something we reinvented, but the Haudenosaunee of New York State and, you know, your Northeast, the rule of the seven generations, where it was thought that you would never do anything to the landscape that would affect the ability for the next seven generations to be able to live and survive and well on the land. That's sort of a basic understanding that should permeate everything. It is just how do we coordinate that as we moved from it being a local lake, a local river, to the whole role of the multinationals, and then the role of things in the 60s, where we realized that pollution and some of the environmental degradation actually was transboundary. And then we started to look at it. So I think your comment about getting a historical perspective on this is an extremely important one. Thank you.
Glenn, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
I guess there's another sort of related piece to this. I'm trying to understand how we balance the need between introducing particular sort of curricular approaches, content areas like history, which I agree would be crucial, with the what I guess I would call sort of the process of people experiencing and talking about all this stuff. Because what we've really got at the problem we really face is that it's really not even possible at a broader social level for us to engage in dialogue about these matters without it becoming so polarized. Mm-hmm. And what I'm interested in is, would it ever be possible to start with where is it that people are coming from fundamentally on these issues to begin with? Because, you know, we here might be very comfortable here in the studio, and certainly you, Chuck, would be very comfortable with, of course, this is stuff we must be dealing with. And some argue it's even too late, that we should have been dealing with this, you know, in past decades, and we're now attempting to, whereas others look at the whole idea of sustainability and caring for the earth or indigenous peoples, and what they hear is this code language for kind of the left wing taking over society and trying to a global agenda being imposed. And my struggle is, how do we create a connection between these two fundamental worldviews?
Well, one of my hats or roles I wear is I'm the co-director of the Sustainability and Education Academy at the university. It's been set up where we go in and work with reorienting whole school systems for a province or for a major city, etc. And we found the starting point, because in order to reorient the whole system, you're not just talking teachers, you're working with the director of and superintendents of curriculum, superintendent purchasing, the whole bit. And most people do not like being reoriented.
Right.
So the starting point is to go in and say, what kind of a world will our students inherit? And what are the knowledge, skills, the values, the perspectives that they're going to have to acquire to cope with that world that we're going to leave them? And how do we best prepare them for that? Do we just tell them about it, or do we need to model it? How do we reinforce it? How do we build this into even our hiring and promotion policies, etc., and then let people roll up their sleeves and dig in and go to work? But they're doing this not for a political perspective. They're doing it for their kids, their own children and grandchildren, and the students in the system for whom they're responsible.
So,
but
Chuck,
they
I'm
bring
curious
parents
about
along with them.
Chuck Hopkins from York University in Toronto. I'm curious about two things. One is what response you get when you ask those questions of parents. And two, is it possible that the parents that you're speaking to are self-selected to begin with? If they're interested in these types of issues, maybe they are not the politically conservative types that we've heard from a bit today, who are very concerned that environmental concern or a concern about increasing the wealth of the poorest nations and bringing the world into a more equitable situation is a leftist agenda.
Mm-hmm. Well, that... to be fair, I have not done this in the United States. I've lectured and addressed quite a number of different universities and so on in the United States, but I've not gone in and met with parents in the States. So, you know, I think there is quite a... United States does have a very unique perspective on these kinds of things. Now, in other countries, it isn't quite that much of a problem. And parents do seem to be able to sit down and talk. Here in Toronto, we had a huge consultation went on for 7 months, and over 7,000 people came out, and they couldn't just stand up and depute. They had to sit in small groups of 8 to 10 people. And for a half a day, and answer this one question: what should our students know, be able to do, and value enough to act upon? And we boiled down all of that into 6 big graduation outcomes. And one of them was to take care of themselves, and the other was to look after the rest of the world in a sustainable fashion. And that came from the parents themselves. Now, whether you would get that throughout the United States, I don't know. But I do know that if you go in and try and just push your own agenda, as Craig is pointing out, that doesn't go very far. Mm-hmm. There has to be a reason and a purpose for education. But believe me, all education is with purpose.
Tamara, we've only got about 10 seconds left, so you want to tag on to that?
I just want to say that I think getting parents on board comes naturally when they see their children really involved and excited about what they're learning in any capacity, and taking kids outside will do that.
Our guests have been, by phone, the United Nations University Chair on Education for Sustainable Development, Charles Hopkins. Here in studio, the director of Mary Baldwin College's Environmental-Based Learning Program, Tamara Willis, plus the director of the International Beliefs and Values Institute based at Mary Baldwin, as well as a professor of psychology at James Madison University, Craig Sheely. Thank you all for making time for us.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Insight Archives. If you go to that page, you'll find links to more information about all of our guests. Plus, if you go to Virginia Insight's Facebook page and click Like, you'll get more information about these broadcasts there as well. Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.